Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Award-winning novelist and poet Stephen Dobbins returns to the thriller genre after a 15-year hiatus with The Burn Palace. The novel is a blend of suspense, supernatural underpinnings, and sexual shenanigans set in a provincial New England town. Dobbins creates an insular community sideswiped by madness when a series of odd, violent crimes occur in rapid succession. Dobbins is the author of more than 35 novels and poetry collections, including The Church of the Dead Girls, Cemetery Nights, and his popular Charlie Bradshaw Saratoga mystery series. It is a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Dobbins to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Give us a sense of how you came to this particular novel, especially after a hiatus of writing novels.
Well, I've been working on poems and essays in those years in between, and taking notes for some other stuff and teaching. But I had the first scene of the novel in which the snake is put into the crib of the baby in the hospital. And I had thought of that for years, and I had no place really to set it. I wanted some semi-satanic behavior, something that would seem more satanic than actually was. But then I moved down to Westerly, Rhode Island about 8 years ago. And if you look at the map along the coast between Westerly and, say, Wakefield, which is 20 or so miles, you have a large population right along the coast. And then inland, there are a series of parks and swamps and wooded area, really quite wild. And so I thought I could use the two of them. Also in the summer, you know, the area doubles in population, so the winter there's also a lot of empty houses. But I saw it as a metaphor for the conscious and subconscious minds, really. And that doesn't come into the book, but it informed the book.
When you talk about that informing the novel, give us a sense of why it was so important to have this small town. It's Brewster, Rhode Island. It is a community where, as pointed out, most of the population will likely die blocks from where they were born. How does a place like that lend itself to a story like this?
Well, the town that I live in, Westerly, is somewhat like that in the sense that many, many people within the town were born here and will die here. And I was struck by that moving here and the kind of relationships they have with each other over the years and the kind of trust that develops and so on, or friendships or even animosities. But then I thought that I could use that in another book. And so I started thinking about that as well as thinking about that snake in the crib. So then it developed from that. And I took a slice of land. I invented a slice of land or created a slice of land between Charlestown, Rhode Island, and Matunuck, Rhode Island, right on the coast that goes inland to Route 1. And basically that's where Brewster takes place. There's also a beach town called Hanaquit. And so Brewster is that kind of mix. There are people that, as you say, that live there and have been there all their lives, and there are people that can commute to Providence or people that can commute to North Kingston. And I like that mix between the very domestic and local and people coming in from other places.
You mentioned the beginning of the novel, and it's such a striking way to begin it, of with a baby napping and a snake, and here this newborn has been stolen and this writhing 6-foot snake has been left in its place, and there is screaming and great turbulence. Is that what came to you first, of that thought, that moment?
Yes. I mean, it's an exciting moment to pull back a blanket under which something is writhing and find a snake instead of a baby. I now can't remember how it occurred to me, but I know that it was about 20 years ago, and I had to find the suitable place in which to place it. As long as I was thinking of doing a supernatural story, I didn't have enough interest in that, and I wanted to do something that would investigate more the psychology of the people within the community.
What lets you know that you're ready, in the sense of, it would seem frustrating to me to have an idea like that, especially one that is so compelling and strong, and then trying to find a place to put it along with all of your other work?
I think I take notes on it, or I just keep it in mind. I mean, I have a number of scenes like that sort of float around my mind, and I think, you know, maybe I can place them at some point. And the novel comes together usually when several of those come together with some new idea, and I can begin structuring the novel according to those ideas. And that's really what happened with this. I mean, one of the things you learn as a writer is to be patient. And I knew that if I pushed it at any point, I mean, if I manufactured it instead of allowed it into being, then it simply wouldn't be successful.
Were you ready? Was there a part of you, because you were working on other projects, you were working on essays, you were teaching, you were writing poetry, was there an aspect of writing novels that you missed?
Well, a novel is very comfortable once you get into it. I mean, it's like being in a comfortable house or even a comfortable tent. You know what's going to happen next, more or less, and you know that a body of time is taken care of. If I'm working on a short story or a poem or an essay, I don't have that sense of time, of that ability to explore over weeks and months. I mean, I'll explore and say in a poem, but then that's quite brief. And the same thing with an essay. But with a novel, you know, I can count on writing for 6 months or a year, depending on the size of the novel, and then seeing how it all fits together and doing some revision and tidying up and stuff like that. But there's a comfort to it that's very different than from any kind of other writing, I find.
Having read a lot of your work, this seems to be a type of novel that you have never fully explored. I mean, there is that, you've done mystery, but this is such a thriller with these strange and odd moments. Was that always something you wanted to explore and take a little bit further?
Yes, the novel, The Church of Dead Girls, is set in a small town south of Syracuse, basically. And that does some of the same thing in terms of having a community in which people are suddenly turned against one another or are suspicious of one another. But I didn't explore it to the extent that I wanted to explore it. And I wanted to see if I could write a book that had a conflicting tone, as it were, that would be both ominous and have elements of black humor. And so, you know, it evolved into The Burn Palace, those thoughts. And as I say, you know, you have a series of separate ideas, and then they sort of come together, and you question it and imagine what might happen, imagine some kind of narrative arc. And then if you know, if you're happy with what you've imagined, then you'll start doing it. It's really, though, it's the language that's the most important. I mean, you can have the story, but the story is nothing without the language. How are you going to tell the story? And, you know, once I wrote that first scene with Nurse Spandex, I had that mixture of the ghastly and slightly dark humor, well, quite dark humor, that I thought I could use in the book. And then I was able to maintain it.
It seems as though it really does prove or once again illustrates the importance of place, because this novel would be very different if it took place in Syracuse. There's something about our vision of a small New England town.
Well, that's true. Syracuse is full of strangers, or any town above a certain size is full of strangers. And I can see that even in Westerly. Once summer comes, once Memorial Day passes, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people move back into the area, then it also becomes a town of strangers. People stop greeting each other on the streets and at a stop sign or driving. They're very hesitant to let anyone pass in front of them and actually can react with some anger. And there's a complete change in the psychology, or a seeming change in the psychology, during those other months, those other 9 months or 10 months. There's much more geniality. It's very rare that I'll be on the street without someone saying hello to me. They don't know me, but just we walk past each other and nod and maybe exchange a few words. And the town I wanted, Brewster, was is very much like that.
It also,
but you can't.
Go ahead.
You can't. I'm sorry. You can't do that with a large town. There's a kind of optimum size, and it has to be a country town. You couldn't have, say, a suburban area, or it has to be someplace with where people have a sense of being rooted.
There's also that awful feeling of so much going wrong in a small place, where right after the baby's abduction, there's a savage killing that takes place on the edge of a swamp, an Indian reservation that borders the town. And then there is a murder. There is a lot going on in this very small place that is something that I think we can all relate to when you have this incredible chaos and not knowing, because as we so often hear on the news, you know, you don't think that kind of thing happens here.
Exactly. And the things that happen, there's nothing that directly connects them for a long time, except that they're outrageous. And, you know, that's not enough of a connection. There's lots of outrageous things. But certainly they all feel, we all feel that this is not the sort of thing that happens here. You know, we can think of lots of incidents in the past year where some outrageous thing has happened, like those shootings in Newtown, in Connecticut. And, you know, you can just imagine how many of the people in that town said, well, nothing like that has ever happened here or would happen here. And bad things can happen any place.
Talk a little bit about the central character, Woody Potter, who is the state police detective assigned to the original case and sort of gets sucked into all of this.
He's somewhat dour. He's been disappointed in various things. His girlfriend has just left him. You know, one of the difficulties of being a cop, a married cop, is that the hours that you're working and the fact that you're taking off in the middle of the night, or, you know, there are things that obviously come before the marriage or the relationship if you plan to keep your job. And the state police is very much of a military organization. You go through basic training for a number of weeks, and, you know, obviously they all have different ranks, etc. So he's been disappointed in that, and he's also was in the Gulf War, and he has some residue from that. And he's very much no nonsense. I mean, he doesn't believe in things that he can't touch with his hand. And that being the case, he has suspicions all the way through that there's some kind of satanic or otherworldly element. I mean, he doubts this. He has no particular reason for that, but it's just he's not the sort of person that would accept that kind of possibility. And so he goes forward. I mean, he's a very stubborn man and just plods forward in his course. And he has a partner who's very different than he is, but who supports him, and they support each other, and together they remain stubborn or patient enough to see it to the end.
It's probably cliche, but these characters really are larger than life. They're very vivid.
Well, you have to make somebody that sticks in the mind. There was a wonderful mystery writer in England, Marjorie Allingham, who said that you read a mystery for the plot and you remember it for the character. And that's pretty much what I wanted. And I wanted the interactions between the characters. I mean, you can't have an interaction between a character unless the characters are already three-dimensional, already have a imagined past and future. So I wanted to create characters that you could imagine that future. You could imagine where they came from, and you could imagine where they would go and how they would respond to other people, et cetera, and their relationships. And that's partly a matter of giving them habits and giving them outside concerns or concerns outside of the immediate case at hand. And then just giving them different ways of talking and idiosyncrasies. This is very difficult. I mean, that's not difficult. But when I was first starting to write, I thought, how do I keep these people straight? You know, I can't give every one of them a wart on his nose or have to have a cane. And when I did give somebody a cane or a wart on their nose, I kept forgetting about it and have to go back. But you see what I mean. You have to, the three-dimensionality of the characters has to be credible.
Stephen Dobbins is the author of the new novel, The Burn Palace. It is published by Blue Rider Press, and he is our guest on this week's book show. I first became aware of your work through reading the Charlie Bradshaw Saratoga series, and it struck me in reading this of something that Dennis Lehane told me a few years ago when he was branching out from writing a mystery series to writing larger and more broad and more period pieces, that the wonderful thing about a mystery series is that it has this very defined form, but the horrible thing about it is that it's a defined form and you can't really break out of it. Did you feel that way?
Somewhat, yes. I mean, you're always trying to struggle against against that form. I mean, one of the things that you have in trying to write a sonnet, for instance, obviously a sonnet has 14 lines and 144 syllables, and you want to write something that has a sense of space, that doesn't seem to be confined by that form, that there's a limitlessness to it in terms of its ideas and themes and so on. And that's what I also would try to do with a mystery novel. But as you say, people go to a mystery novel to find the mystery, so you can't leave that mystery too far behind. After a while, I think, if you have a series with the same characters, the reader also reads because of his or her interest in those characters. But there has to be a mystery, and you have to start right away with some kind of conflict or strife or something that jars the nature of the town, jars the complacency of the town. Saratoga is very much, well, it's certainly bigger than Brewster, but it too is a town where people have lived all their lives, and there's a lot of, at the same time, there's a lot of coming and going because of the racetrack and various other festivals.
Once you moved on from that place, did you feel less comfortable writing about it, or were you just done with the form?
I was fairly done with the form. I mean, I have another one that's almost finished that I've been fooling around with for a number of years. I wrote part of it, and then I set it aside, and I felt that I had those characters just dangling in the air someplace, and that I had to finish the book just to get it out of my mind, because having the book unfinished, that it kept going around saying, well, what's this going to happen? What's going to happen? So now it's the first half of the book is finished and the second half needs revision, but I don't know what's going to happen with it. But at the moment, there is this one more, and it'll be probably the last one.
Is there pleasure that comes with revisiting those characters?
Very much so. I know what they're going to say. I know how they're going to act. And that makes things much easier. I mean, any character in a book is all the way through is reacting to stimuli. And if you know that character very well and have used him or her before, then you know how that reaction is going to be. And so you can just plop down the stimuli and like a shooting or whatever it might be, and see how they behave in relation to it, in reaction to it. And that's there's a kind of comfort in that. So there's kind of a warm bath feeling of being amongst friends, as it were.
It seems that when you read a story like that, you say, wow, this is really good. This is really fun, and this is a really good story and a wonderful addition to the series. When I read this, when I read The Burn Palace, I was like, damn, he's a really, really good writer, which I knew, of course. But there's that point where you look at it differently because this is much longer than those. It is much more detailed. The characters are so defined, and there's so much weird stuff going on, and it all comes together. So in a way, it really does allow you to, I mean, for want of a better term, show off more of what you can do as a writer.
I mean, certainly it's more ambitious, and that was one of the things that separated as well from the Saratoga books. They have for me many, many qualities, but they're not particularly ambitious. And the Burn Palace and also the Church of Dead Girls were far more ambitious in terms of their relationships between people and the characterization and the places and the crisis that was moving everything along.
You touched on this when you were talking about sonnets a moment ago, but does poetry and your life as a poet inform or assist in your novel writing?
I like to imagine that it makes me more sensitive to the writing. I mean, I worked as a journalist for a number of years, and, you know, I enjoyed it. But your writing as a journalist is, you know, is very straightforward and direct, at least the kind of thing I was doing. I was working for the Detroit News at this one point. And, you know, they didn't want anything flowery. So they just wanted it clear and exact and quick. And I learned a lot, a great deal from that. But with a novel, there needs to be some other voice. And the Saratoga book certainly had a kind of voice. But the new book and other books I've done have a much different voice. I mean, there's, in a way, you're trying to see what you can get away with. And you're stretching the form, the various ideas about the form, and just to see what you can get away with. And I like that. I mean, I liked how it begins and moves through a kind of overview of the town. I mean, I've often thought of Franz Kafka's story, Metamorphosis, which has the first sentence, Gregor Samsa woke after a night of uneasy dreams and found he had been transformed into a gigantic insect. That's a sentence that could be in no other place than at the beginning. If you popped it into the middle of the story, you'd never, never accept it. And in the first chapter or the first paragraphs, those are the places that the reader is most accepting, because the reader wants to see how it's going to turn out. And then by the end of that chapter, the reader has made certain assumptions. And some of those you can challenge, but there are others that you can't change the whole nature of it. You don't want to lose credibility in the eyes of the reader. And so things like that snake and Karl Kraus and the way I describe that, he comes in the last part of that same chapter, a man who's off his meds, and how I describe the town, those are things that would really only be possible to do, I think, in the first chapter. I'm sure you can get away with them later, but it would take a lot more work.
When you use that phrase, get away with something, do you mean for you? Do you mean for the authenticity with the reader, or do you mean both?
I mean both. I mean, it has to work for me. I mean, I have the idea, but then I have to put it into language, and that becomes a separate thing. You know, it works for me without the language. So I have to find language that will communicate it in such a way that the reader will buy it. Any writer is always trying to sell the reader the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, you want them to believe what you're doing. And there are many writers, maybe all writers, will enjoy pushing that edge a bit. You know, what can you get away with? Maybe not all writers, but I hate any possibility of self-parody, I think. And so each novel becomes quite different from the one before.
This new novel is really wonderful and just a hell of a read. It is Burn Palace. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Stephen Dobbins, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world, and I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoy these.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Again, the name of the book is Burn Palace. It is published by Blue Rider Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
I was born on Snake Hill, and that's where I'll probably die. 'Cause I don't like to kill, but I've got poison in my bite. Well, I feel safe to say that I should probably stay up on Snake Hill.